Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. The International Monetary Fund estimates that inflation in Venezuela could reach more than 13,000% this year. 2 pounds of chicken or beef costs as much as the monthly minimum wage package, and that includes food coupons that are worth about $2.50. And yet, President Nicolas Maduro won re-election on Sunday. Here to tell us more about the country and its economic predicament is Ricardo Hausmann. He is the former Minister of Planning for Venezuela and Director of the Center for International Development and Economics Professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Ricardo Hausmann, thank you very much for being with us. Maybe you could just give us your thoughts and reactions to Sunday's election and what that means for the future of your country.
Well, the first thing is that the election was a sham. It was an election in which the three major opposition parties were outlawed. The two major opposition candidates were disqualified. The opposition boycotted the election. The government got two candidates to participate in the election that were in the fringes of the opposition. Those two candidates denounced the result as being fraudulent. The international community has decided not to recognize these results. So the only novelty is that Maduro is still the president of Venezuela, but that his international legitimacy is even further eroded. On the economic front, the government went on a spending spree in the months to the elections. They didn't have the money to spend, so they just printed it. The money supply increased by 61% in the 4 weeks to the election. That's an annualized rate of 50,000% a year. Monthly inflation is running at an annual equivalent of something like 50,000% also. I think that the IMF numbers that you just quoted at 13% now look extremely optimistic. So I think that it will just be the continuous deterioration of the country until there is regime change.
Yeah, and all those numbers somehow get overshadowed by the images that we've seen, not only of the lines, but of children and others just completely emaciated, lacking food. I'm wondering, what do you think that the international community should do in response?
Well, I think there was a very quick response by this Lima group that is composed of the U.S., Canada, and the major Latin American countries. They have decided not to recognize the result. They have decided to recall their ambassadors, to lower their degree of diplomatic interaction, to call for an Organization of American States meeting. And they are a little bit shell-shocked by the magnitude of the emigration, of the refugee crisis that is occurring in Venezuela. This last week, the government of Colombia announced the results of having given Venezuelans a month to register. Last year, they had given them a month to register and 60,000 people registered. This year, they gave the ones that were not registered last year, they gave them a month to register so long as they had entered the country legally. Over 200,000 registered. So this is a lower estimate of the amount of new out-migration into Colombia, but most people continue on to Peru, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Central America. You know, in Panama, there's a big community in Costa Rica, or they go to the U.S., Spain, and other destinations. So right now, this is promises to be a refugee crisis of Syrian magnitudes, and that means that the international community needs to act because it is becoming a very serious domestic policy issue.
So when we talk about actions, one has been just boycotting Venezuelan oil, being one of their mainstays of the entire economy. And we are seeing PDVSA, the state-owned oil producer, its bonds falling as people expect them to continue to suffer with fewer output. So I'm just wondering, I mean, is that the right response, given the fact that that, you know, potentially could go to feeding people?
Well, there are essentially no sanctions on PDVSA. The problems in PDVSA are self-inflicted. It is the fact that the government decided to use PDVSA as a cash cow and not to invest in oil, and that has caused a catastrophic collapse in production. The sanctions that have most bite are individual sanctions on people who have been narco-trafficking, laundering money, and so on. And that includes, you know, the vice president of the country who, the Office of Foreign Asset Control, OFAC, froze $900 million in assets to his name or to the name of his secretary. So they've now issued other sanctions to other top officials, and that's complicating their life. But the problems of the oil company are not the consequence of international action. They're the consequence of self-inflicted wounds.
What do you believe is the ultimate strategy of President Maduro?
Well, I think he's just trying to hang on. And he's betting on the idea that this economic catastrophe, which is right now, it's running at twice the size of the U.S. Great Depression. So it's twice as large, the decline in output, as the U.S. Great Depression. That it will weaken society faster than it weakens the government, so that the relative power of the government vis-a-vis society does not change. I think the situation is just unsustainable, and unsustainable situations tend not to be sustained. So I think eventually there will be regime change. But right now, what I think will happen is that because there is no short-term electoral solution, there's no short-term dates for elections, the need for other forms of regime change will have to be put on the table.
You were talking about the refugee crisis that may eclipse what's happening in Syria. And I'm wondering, from your personal perspective, Professor, because you are the former Venezuelan Minister of Planning, former head of the Presidential Office of Coordination and Planning, do you think it's the right move for people to just leave there as quickly as they can? Or do you think that there is anybody there who could augur for change? I mean, would you go back?
Well, I mean, I think that if I went back, it is a very good likelihood that I'll end up in prison. So, as are many political leaders. So, I think that people need to survive, and their families need to survive. And one way to do so is for somebody in the family to leave and try to earn some income, because you know, the minimum wage is less than $3 a month. And it doesn't buy enough calories to feed a single person, much less a family. And the median worker earns the minimum wage. So the minimum wage in Venezuela is hard to earn, and it doesn't feed anybody. So it's just a stampede. The oil company is unable to retain its workers. It's lost some 35,000 workers in the last year. The electricity companies are unable to retain its workers. They're leaving the country in droves. So now there's a water crisis. The water system was not maintained, and so there's a big water crisis that is having deleterious effects on the health standards of people. So it's just a really serious catastrophic situation. The international community, in essence, is telling the Venezuelan armed forces that if they were to act, they would see it as a reasonable action on their side. And I think that the internal cohesion of the government is going to be further weakened. They already had a significant number of people leaving their political system, their political coalition. And so I see just a further weakening at an enormous humanitarian cost until there is regime change.
Can you tell us about the military in Venezuela? And do you believe that there are individuals in positions of power that will take it into their own hands to alleviate the crisis that the country is going through?
Well, the top brass is deeply involved in narco trafficking, money laundering, smuggling, in all sorts of different criminal activities. Many of them have been sanctioned by the U.S., Canada, the European Union, and so on. They are involved in significant, financial crimes.
Yeah.
They have violated human rights enormously. So the question is, will the middle-ranking officers that are also starving decide to follow the orders of this top brass, or will there be a break in military discipline? And that could itself be relatively messy.
Ricardo Hausmann, thank you so much for being with us. And we need to have you back as the situation progresses. He is director of the Center for International Development and professor of the practice of economic development at Harvard's Kennedy School. He is also the former minister of planning for Venezuela. President Trump tweeted this morning, China has agreed to buy massive amounts of additional farm/agricultural products. Would be one of the best things to happen to our farmers in many years. Certainly, people who trade futures on soybeans and corn seemed enthusiastic by thawing of trade tensions between the U.S. and China, with futures popping ahead of trading, continuing to see some of their rise in early trading in the market. Alan Bierker joins us now. He's agricultural reporter for Bloomberg News and Bloomberg Radio host. Alan, thank you so much for being with us. I would love to get your take, first of all, on what we've seen between the U.S. and China, and kind of just to sort of emphasize how important this is for U.S. agricultural industries.
I think one thing that's important to remember with agriculture and some of its reaction to the Trump administration's move is what's now become the famous phrase, folks in the media take Trump literally but not seriously, whereas his followers take him seriously but not literally. When you take a look at agriculture markets and everything that's been going on with China, when Trump rattles the saber, of course, people get concerned with sorghum prices and soybean prices and such. And so, but they don't think there's an impending catastrophe. They're not necessarily following the headlines as closely. You're seeing the same thing today. I mean, obviously, the president tweeting that this is good for farmers and there could be some massive new increases in agriculture are bullish for markets. And you're seeing that market reaction. But like so many things with this administration, there's a very much a wait and see attitude. You don't know if the trade talk will turn sour in a couple, 3 months when the president is trying to shore up re-election campaigns with perhaps some anti-China rhetoric. You haven't actually seen these sales materialize. That said, there is reason to be bullish because this is actually an area where, indeed, if China wanted to try to reduce its trade deficit with the U.S., agriculture would be a logical place to go, because this is a case where the U.S. does have a supply of something for which there is demand in China. And so there probably is something real behind this rhetoric. At this point, of course, the question is, how real is it going to be?
Okay. At the same time, we don't have a farm bill, do we?
No, we don't have a farm bill. And that's another part of this narrative. And this is exactly the narrative that the president is trying to counter with this China announcement, that Republican leadership and a Republican White House hasn't necessarily been a blessing for the farmers that voted for the president. On Friday, you saw the House Farm Bill, which looked like it was on a path to passage. People were starting to become more optimistic that this thing that did not have any Democratic support could actually get through the House. When it got derailed by the House Freedom Caucus, which wants to use the Farm Bill basically as leverage to have a vote on a controversial immigration plan. The Farm Bill is this nice sort of mid-range bill where it's not so absolutely important that it must be passed immediately, but it's not so unimportant that it can't be taken hostage and used to be extracted for concessions. That's what happened. The concern with rural Republicans, especially Republicans in rural districts, were expressed by a guy, freshman Congressman Jody Arrington. He represents the Lubbock, West Texas, Abilene area, saying, you know, farmers have to be scratching their heads over some of the actions that this Republican Congress and Republican administration have been taking that have not necessarily been playing into the interests of what agriculture might want. This is a constituency that surveys show voted about two-thirds for the president. And thus far, whenever there's a problem, a decision made between Rust Belt rural and Farm Belt rural, it always seems like the Farm Belt gets the short end. We'll see if this China decision just recently that starts to push a counter narrative.
All right, so let's put into perspective how much agricultural America depends on China for its well-being.
Quite a heck of a lot. Thanks for asking that question. About one-third of all U.S. soybeans go straight to China. And sorghum, it's actually a higher proportion. Cotton, it's also, I think, about one quarter. And some of these markets have really emerged. I mean, there was very little sorghum exported to China before 2011, and now it's become incredibly dependent on it. China, of course, has been this big source of growth. And when you saw that big agricultural boom sort of in the late 2000s, 2012, 2013, it was being driven by ethanol and by China. What's kind of interesting about this announcement is when you take a look at how China might be buying more U.S. agricultural goods, one of the things that China is looking at is putting more ethanol in its cars.
Interesting.
If ethanol becomes a driver of corn demand in China the way it was a driver of corn demand in the U.S., that has profound impacts on corn markets. We haven't seen the markets react quite to that yet, but I'm sure suddenly a bunch of traders are going to become big experts on China ethanol policy because that's one place where money could move quickly.
That's fascinating. I'm just wondering, because we heard about these cartons of U.S. agricultural produce just rotting in the ports because China didn't want to or delayed admission while these trade tensions were building with the U.S. Have we seen any impact from that activity already on prices?
Well, that was what was pushing things down. You know, it's not even so much the lack of sales because markets are fungible. They have a way to react. You know, if Brazil starts selling all their soybeans to China, the U.S. soybeans will go someplace. But as you noted, in the meantime, while the confusion reigns, they can actually sit in a port and lose value. And that indeed has been going on. How much of that is reversible is going to kind of depend on some of the logistics of the shipment itself, but we have seen a little bit of a glimpse of what could happen when China stops buying, which is going to give markets a lot of relief if they get a signal like today that they might be buying again.
Alan, if we were to tour the winter wheat belt, what would we find right now?
Well, you know, the Midwest got pummeled with a lot of rain. The question is it too late for the harvest? You know, especially in Kansas, more your southern plains, they're starting to look at preparing fields and doing some harvesting in the next few weeks. I'm sure they're going to be taking a look at the quality of the crops right now and figuring out whether some of the moisture that they've gotten will actually help them out.
So where are we going to see any kind of big changes in agriculture? Is it going to be weather related or is it going to be purely because of the confrontation with China?
We're not quite into the weather market yet, although we're getting there. You know, planting is now pretty fully underway. In a lot of more southern parts of the country, your spring planting has been done. If you're my parents up in Minnesota, you're just getting into your fields right now because you had those late season snowstorms. But at this point, it is unusual. Some of these macro trade moves are actually moving markets in a way that weather won't. I guarantee you, come July and August, it's not going to matter what President Trump is saying about trade. Farmers are going to wonder if there's rain, and that's what's going to move commodity markets in Chicago.
Alan, what's the one thing we should be looking for to see whether the thawing of the trade talks is real?
You got to be looking at weekly export sales. The USDA puts out reports on Thursday about how much got bought of where. If you start seeing tangible changes in these volumes, then indeed this is real and this is a bull market.
Give you 20 seconds. NAFTA, where are we there?
NAFTA, again, just uncertainty, things sort of muddling along. And that's a case where the farm constituency has sort of become comfortable with this uncertainty. You don't see NAFTA being the driver the way it was a few months ago.
All right. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Alan Bjorka is our expert for all things agriculture, our agriculture reporter from Bloomberg, joining us from our 99.1 studios in Washington, D.C. Yes, Lisa.
I love looking at the futures of corn and of sorghum and soy. I think this is super important. I think that this is a lot of where the trade deal and the trade negotiations will live. And it seems that there is definitely some skepticism because there isn't the same kind of runaway rally.
Well, you've seen, you've seen a 50 cent per bushel increase in the price of corn since the beginning of the year. So,
but that's due to a lot of things, right? There are a bunch of different factors with people planting less of them, less of corn plants and more soybeans. So,
right.
I mean, there are a bunch of different factors, but yes, there's been a market increase.
And we're going to watch and see if they can get a farm bill together. I know that the Senate has their own version of a farm bill that they are trying to put together.
Bloomberg Markets brought to you by BNY Mellon's Insight 2018 conference, a must attend for advisors, June 6th through the 8th in Orlando, Florida. Register at BNYMelloninsight.com. Pim, let's talk about robotics.
By all means.
Please.
Artificial intelligence.
And artificial intelligence and all that great stuff. We're looking at the Robo ETF. It's a $2.3 billion ETF. And last year returned more than 44%. I want to bring in the CEO and partner of Robo Global LLC, Travis Briggs, who comes to us from Dallas, Texas. Travis, thank you so much for joining us. I want to start with what makes a company a robotics company?
Well, thank you for having me. The lens that we look at robotics, automation, and AI is really from a percentage of revenue directly or indirectly attributed to robotics and automation. So when you look at the index, you'd be surprised to know there's over 80 companies, and they all focus on different parts of the value chain of robotics and automation. So half of the index is focused on the technologies that enable the enabling technologies that allow robotics to actually sense, process, and act. The other half is the applications like drones or industrial manufacturing robots or logistics automation or healthcare robots, things that you would immediately recognize.
Travis, maybe let's talk about some examples if we can. That way people can get a better idea. For example, Oceaneering International, they use robotic and remote sensing technology in order to become more efficient in the oil industry.
That's right. So that's one of the components of our energy sector. Oceaneering, which is a bellwether, meaning it has a high revenue attribution to robotics, uses what's called remote operated vehicles. And those are simply robots that can go very deep into the sea to monitor, to perform maintenance, to perform drilling. It essentially allows companies, energy companies, to drill where they hadn't been able to drill before.
And also you've got Intuitive Surgical. So that's another healthcare application. That's another example of a company in the index, right? They have the Da Vinci surgical system.
That's absolutely right. We're seeing that's one of the biggest growth areas is in surgical robotics with not only Intuitive Surgical, but also Mazor Robotics and others that are in the index. So you've touched on a couple of companies on the application side. Let me give you an example of a company that maybe your listeners haven't heard of on the technology side, and that's Cognex. That's a U.S.-based company, world-leading machine vision company. You think, okay, well, what does machine vision have to do with robotics? Turns out it's a critical enabling technology of robotics. When you think about surgical robots, you think about industrial manufacturing robots, or even drones, a key component is their ability to see, right, is to sense their surroundings. So the machine vision, the technology component, actually applies across multiple applications.
Well, I'll just say that we do know about Cognex because it's based in Natick, and of course, Natick and Boston area, home
there
to
you
Bloomberg,
go.
1061 Boston, Newburyport. But the stock's down 24% this year. Why is that?
Well, I'll say this. Stocks will go up and down in the short term, but if you increase that lens to look back 2.5 years ago, I think the stock's probably up over 100%. So short-term pullback, but the previous 2 years have been outstanding for the company. And we think the future continues to look bright.
So, Travis, I want to zoom out a little bit because we hear a lot about how artificial intelligence is going to transform every industry out there. Are you noticing that an increasing number of companies are deriving a greater proportion of their revenues from robotics and artificial intelligence and automation?
Yeah, the question on artificial intelligence is a really good one because it highlights how quickly this area is changing. You know, we launched that index when it'll be 5 years ago in August, and the reality is AI was a footnote. And within the last two years, I'd say AI has become at the forefront of all conversations around automation. And the reason that is we now have extremely powerful sensors and processing chips that price reasonably. You have these massive data centers that can process enormous amounts of data. And essentially, when you think of AI, it's algorithms, processing power, and then data. And 90% of all the digital data that's been captured through history was captured in the last 2 years.
Now, you created the index, correct?
That is correct.
And what motivates the index? In other words, is there a person that decides what goes in, what goes out?
Yeah, so the primary objective when we created the index was to capture the entire ecosystem, or think of it as the value chain. We wanted to make sure that when this theme of robotics and automation continued to grow and expand as quickly as it has, that we had identified the companies that would benefit from that. And we realized early on that the best approach was a diversified one. And so, as I mentioned earlier, we chose to capture the entire value chain, everything from the sensors, the processing, the computing, you know, to the end-use applications, as you mentioned, oceaneering, surgical robots, industrial manufacturing robots, and such.
So, as I mentioned earlier, the robo ETF was up more than 44% last year. This year, it's underperforming some of the broader U.S. stock indices. What do you expect? I mean, what do you attribute to sort of the underperformance, and what do you see the potential outperformance later?
Sure. I think if you look at the index and the performance of the index since inception, which has booked over a four-year track record, on average, it has outperformed the broad market indices, and I think when you have a focus on companies that are growing as quickly as this robotics and automation sector is that you would hope, right? The obvious objective is to outperform broad market indices over traditional market cycles.
Just quickly, when you talk about robotics, does that also include sort of systems in the aerospace and defense industry?
So we do have a subsector. There are 12 subsectors in the index, one of which is surveillance. And it does include companies that are focused on researching and development for the unmanned aerial vehicle applications.
Got it. For drones.
Yep, that's right.
Thanks very much for being with us. Travis Briggs is the chief executive and the partner of Robo, a global based in Dallas, Texas, helping to manage more than $2.4 billion. Shares of General Electric, they're higher by 3.5%. The shares of Wabtec, they are up more than 4.25%. Here to tell us more, Brooke Sutherland, industrials and deals columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Brooke, always a pleasure. Maybe you could just explain what exactly is General Electric doing with its locomotive business?
Bit complicated. So what they're going to do is they're going to actually sell a portion of the locomotive business to Wabtec. Then they're going to spin off what's left of the transportation division to its own shareholders, and then they'll merge that spun off portion with Wabtec. So sort of a roundabout way, and the reason why they're doing that is that this all ends up being tax-free to shareholders. which is what investors like to see. GE will get a $2.9 billion cash payment up front, and then between it and its shareholders, it'll own about 50.1% of the combined entity.
So let's take a step back. Yes, shares are up today, but they are still down nearly 11% so far year to date. General Electric is widely expected to have to restructure its entire operations, possibly sell off dramatic parts of its business. So do we get any insight into what the leadership is thinking with respect to that restructuring based on the deal announced today?
Sure. So transportation is a division that they have flagged for divestiture since about November. So they said, you know, we're looking at options for this. So it's definitely good to see a deal actually happening here. I think investors were starting to get a little bit restless that we hadn't really seen any sort of major portfolio action. So they did an asset sale a little while ago with a healthcare IT business, but that was fairly small. And so this is the most significant thing we've seen to date. But, you know, I do think sort of the devil is in the details here. And, you know, they've done asset divestitures before, and the purchase price has wound up not being as great as it looks, just because, you know, you have to use some of that cash. In the case of the industrial solutions business that they sold to ABB last year, use some of that cash to pay back GE Capital for accounts receivables. You have deal taxes. And then there's the pension liabilities that are associated with a lot of these businesses. Oftentimes, GE retains those liabilities and does not pass those on to the buyer, which creates sort of an obvious problem as you look down the line in terms of more divestitures, possible breakups. You know, how does GE find a home for all of these assets and yet still get stuck with a very big pension liability?
Is there any information as to why they believe that combining their locomotive business with Wabtec is good for them?
Sure. You know, I do think this is a good deal on the face of it. You know, I think for Wabtec, it's clearly very transformational, significantly increases its business. You know, the locomotive business is at sort of a cyclical low point. Demand has been weak, but we're just starting to see that pick up. This combined entity will be able to take advantage of that. It'll have opportunities for cost savings, higher profitability. You know, I think on the face of it, it makes sense. It's just as you sort of take a step back and look at what this means bigger picture for GE, I think that's where really sort of the interesting element is. And, you know, it's been sort of talked about, could you do a full-blown breakup of GE? And I think this structure with Wabtec, where you have, you know, sort of a convoluted way of holding on to a stake in the combined business and still getting some cash out of it, is something that GE could explore for other pieces of its business. But just to go back to what I was talking to you before, the real question is, you know, what you do with sort of the liabilities that are attached to these businesses. We don't have details on that yet. I expect that will come in regulatory filings, and that's going to be something investors are going to want to pay close attention to.
How do you have a sense of the volume of pension liabilities that could get sort of shunted back to GE if that's part of this deal?
Sure. So the underfunded pension was about $28.7 billion at the end of 2017.
Overall, for all of GE?
For all of GE. You know, JP Morgan Chase and co-analyst Steve Tusa did some interesting work on the industrial solutions business and pointed out that, you know, the pension associated with assets held for sale was about $42 million, even though industrial solutions has, I think it's about 13,000 employees. So obviously it should be a much bigger percentage. Transportation, I believe, has about 8,000 employees. So, I mean, if you sort of extrapolate what we saw with industrial solutions and apply that to maybe a potential outcome for transportation, again, we don't have any details on this yet, so it's sort of hard to say. But, you know, if you have sort of a similar percentage, you can easily see how GE gets stuck with sort of these billions of liabilities without assets underneath to support that.
Well, I know that Lisa's eager to get her hands on an HSP 46 high horsepower passenger locomotive that
That's
I know
correct.
That Wabtec actually builds already with a partnership with General Electric.
That demand,
you know, honestly, Pim knows my innermost dreams and thoughts when it comes to locomotives and
you know,
and
I'll just let you know, the launch customer for the for one version of this, the HSP 46, is the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority
and Lisa Abramowitz.
Yeah.
Thank you so
only
much.
It cost about $110 million apiece,
and you'll front me the money. Okay, Brooke Sutherland, thank you so much for being with us. Really fascinating, really good insights on the idea of these pension liabilities, which could potentially make investors a little less enthusiastic about this cash infusion. Brooke Sutherland is an industrials and deals columnist for Bloomberg Opinion.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.